ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In the course of my travels, I've been recording nature soundscapes with the aim of helping you, Australia, to relax. And in this particular overnight recording, there was this one duck that just kept screaming its guts out. Anyway, don't worry, I've selected only the best, most relaxing soundscapes that absolutely do not feature this duck. Find Nature Sounds by Anne Jones wherever you get your podcasts and on the ABC Listen app.
Hello, I'm Claire Nichols, and it's so great to be with you for The Book Show, where I bring you conversations with your favourite fiction authors. The Australian writer Babak Saeed is going to join you soon, but before that, Meg Mason is here, and I know so many of you adored her breakout novel Sorrow and Bliss, really a trailblazer for sad girl fiction. Meg has got a new book, and with this book comes a really interesting question. Have you ever fallen in love with a book? I guess we all have, right? But have you ever fallen in love with the author of that book? Have you felt yourself becoming more and more obsessed with that writer, wanting to know everything about them, maybe even having conversations with them in your mind? That's what happens for the hero of Meg's new book. Her name is Sophie. The book is called Sophie Standing There. And Sophie, she works at a writer's festival and she finds herself becoming completely and utterly fixated on one particular writer, a superstar author. Meg, it's great to have you back on The Book Show.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be back here, not least because it means I've actually finally written another book.
Did it feel really hard to write a novel after the juggernaut that was Sorrow and Bliss?
I knew it was going to be hard, and that was partly because everybody kept telling me that it was going to be hard, coupled with telling me that whatever I wrote next wasn't going to be nearly as successful, so I didn't even need to worry about it, which was kind of them and well-intentioned. But, you know, those things, you absorb them and they become really true. And the landscape had shifted for me by the time I got home from Sorrow and Bliss. You know, before that, I was a journalist and I sort of wrote novels as a hobby. And then Sorrow and Bliss turned it into my full-time job. And you come back and it's like, you know, when astronauts come back from the moon, they generally get divorced.
Uh-huh.
It was a bit like that insane re-entry where you just couldn't really describe to people what had happened. And so you just kind of push it all down deep inside you and don't talk about it. But when you come back to your desk, it's kind of all there needing to be processed. And I was so intent on not writing about writers because that can become very insular and very sort of almost a bit clicky that I hadn't been consciously collecting material. So I set out to write a couple of different books, all about very different things that I hadn't experienced. And eventually this one sort of just asserted itself as if to say, you have to write this before you can write anything else. It was almost like a cleansing. So it is about a woman called Sophie who I was listening to your lovely introduction. And you know, when you talk about being fixated or you talk about parasocial relationships, it immediately sounds really creepy.
Yeah.
Like the character Sophie, you go into it now thinking she must be unhinged. You know, she's stalking this woman, you know, this author. But I think the whole message of the book around, you know, this one strand that is the parasocial relationship is that it's so normal. And if you say you haven't done it, you haven't experienced it, you're possibly lying. Because I think we've all at different times, not just as teenagers, but as adults, kind of come to someone, whether it's an author or someone on social media who's not even necessarily an influencer, just someone you don't know, has come to represent something and someone in your life. And thinking about it more sort of after I wrote the book, you know, Sophie has experienced this catastrophe in her personal life. She's a lovely, personable, well-liked, really kind, optimistic person. But this thing has happened to her that means she sort of lost everyone in her life. And in that season of loneliness, she turns to books, which I believe we all do. But exactly as you say, because there is a greater need in her than just probably literature at the time, she sort of starts to invent this author based on the material that's out there, you know, the author's interviews and podcasts, because authors are so much more available than they used to be. And the author becomes almost the closest thing would be an imaginary friend. And unlike, you know, a wonderful best friend, someone you've invented is available to you all the time. If you wake up in the middle of the night, seized with terror, you talk to this person in your mind. And so I think that's what I explored. But the whole time I was really concerned to make sure that it was something we would all relate to rather than, you know, it's not, I don't know if you remember the book Notes on a Scandal, which was made into a film, and Judi Dench was the sort of really worrying psychopathic teacher at the school who then became incredibly obsessed with Cate Blanchett. It's not that. It's entirely opposite.
It's not Misery either.
It's not Misery.
Yeah.
That, if there's a spectrum, it could not be further away from Misery, because Sophie's never going to do anything about it. And also the relationship's never going to be actualized as far as she is concerned, because she lives in this unnamed, fairly dreary town, you know, with what she describes as a semi-thriving literary scene. So as far as she's concerned, this famous author will never come and do her literary festival where she, did we say already that she works as a sound production technician, which is quite funny because I'm here looking through the studio window at a lot of sound production technicians.
We haven't said that yet, but let's get there. So Sophie works at a literary festival. Mm-hmm. I kept imagining Sydney Writers' Festival when I was reading this book, but you don't say where it is.
No, and also Sydney's too chic.
It's something so, more low-key.
Well, it has to be. The reason I didn't name it was because I think it was partly in reaction to the last book, and every book is a reaction to the last book if you're trying to do something really different, which I was. And I'd spent all this time in London. I wanted to sort of almost be finished with that place. You know, that season was over and I'd come home and I was settling down to write. So I didn't want to mentally spend my days in London. But also, like Sydney, London is too chic for Sophie's literary festival. It's too much of a epicenter of the literary world. And I wanted to create it as somewhere that's, it's a really secondary place. This festival is doing its best, but there's, you know, there's no funding and the venue's about to be condemned and all of those things, to just make it less glamorous in a way, which is also why, you know, the natural thing maybe would be for me to write the novel from the author's perspective. Mm. But it was never going to be that. It was always going to be the perspective of Sophie, who's a book lover and who's really near that world, but she's not fully in that world in the way that, you know, the author is herself. So you get to observe a lot from the periphery.
Yeah, because her job essentially is to put the microphones on the writer and the moderator before they go on stage.
Yeah, exactly. To facilitate the conversation of others, but to never really be part of the conversation. And I guess there's a theme which I noticed afterwards, which is this idea of, you know, sort of invisibility and not being recognized for what it is that you do, because, you know, the author comes out on stage and has this wonderful hour-long love-in, you know, with the audience, and it's all bright and wonderfully lit, but there's the wings out the back where everybody is actually working, and it's dark and it's adrenaline fueled, and there's all these people running around serving you as the author, but do you ever remember to thank them, you know, for reaching into your clothing to put the microphone, you know, up inside your clothes, because you're so busy and focused on what you're about to do. And so, yes, a lot of the novel is set in the wings, which is why I think we can feel confident it will never be made into a film, because it's in the dark and one of the characters is chiefly imaginary.
Was that a goal for you, to make an unfilmable novel?
Well, I mean, afterwards I was like, oh, it's a shame. Maybe we could have relocated it to somewhere, or just put a window in there so that there can be some natural light.
I love a story that takes place in the wings of any sort of performance space. Mm-hmm. You do have a bit of fun with this, particularly in the opening chapters. Sophie tells us about George Saunders, you know, being someone mm-hmm. who famously complains about microphones distracting him.
Whilst being in the real world, the nicest man on earth, the sort of kindest man. And that was so fun because, like the previous book, I wrote this to begin with just truly for myself, because tonally it's just very plain and demotic and fun, and it's full of intentional grammatical mistakes because it's from Sophie's point of view, and she's very much self-taught when it comes to literature, and she's very earnest and non-performative, so the voice is hers. But when I was writing it for myself, because I knew I was going to have an author who I'd invented, I had to surround her with real authors to make the world seem real. Like mm-hmm. I could give you one real author, but I couldn't give you 10 and expect you to believe. And so I wanted readers, once it was going into the outside world to recognize these names. And, you know, Elizabeth Strout is in there and Anne Patchett's in there and Bonnie Garmus is commended for her wonderful hair. And, you know, Mick Herron is there, all of these people. And so it just made it really fun. But I think because there is a satirical element to it, lovingly satirical, because it's a world I obviously adore and was so privileged to have a window into, I hope it's obvious that I love them all.
Yeah, I thought George Saunders would be tickled by that, truly.
Yes, well, do you know, because I felt that I thought I was legally obliged to ask permission. It turns out I could have done it without that, but I wasn't just referencing them or their books, you know, as like, this is Sophie's favourite book. I was using them as characters. And so I didn't really feel, you know, I could make George Saunders have a tantrum and David Sedaris nearly trips over. And, you know, I had to ask them and they all did individually come back and say yes, which I was stunned by. And it also was this enormous comfort as the editing part kicks off. You know, there's that creative rush when you're writing it. And then the editing is so different because you're challenging the book and looking only for errors and poor writing. And, you know, you've by then forgotten about any part that you loved. You're just focusing on what's wrong with it. And your confidence can, you know, drop commensurately. But at that time, I'm like, I better start emailing these people and asking. And as they came back one by one and said yes, I was like, well, it can't be that terrible then. Because would George Saunders let himself be in there out of pity? I mean, he might, to be honest, now that I've said that. He probably did feel sorry for me and my sad fanfic. But there you are. It's happened now.
I highly doubt it. I want to come back to our main character, Sophie. So we've said she's got the job at the literary festival. She's miking people up. Her job is to be almost invisible to those authors because their eyes are on that glittering audience outside. You said Sophie's gone through a personal crisis. What is going on in Sophie's life in this period that we meet her?
Well, she's 37. And her marriage is crumbling through no fault of her own. She's now finds herself living by herself for, you know, the first time in 11 years. And her best friend, she's become somewhat estranged from her because she didn't, you know, Sophie didn't understand or would never have anticipated the way that the end of your most central relationship can sort of ripple out and affect the rest of your relationships. Mm-hmm. And her wonderful brother, who she adores, has moved away. And so she's in this time of having to really start again with nothing, right down to the fact that her precious books are presently boxed up in her husband's garage and totally inaccessible to her. So she just feels in every single way untethered. But she loves her job. And because she is this natural person who is most concerned for other people and she's stoic, she doesn't express any of that. So you kind of at work, you see her being capable and competent and everybody adores her, but then she'll go home and experience these absolute caverns of loneliness. And so I guess it's that sort of polarity that I wanted to show. But I also enjoyed writing somebody who doesn't express every single feeling she's feeling as she's feeling it. It was really fun to work with a stoic.
Especially after Sorrow and Bliss, I guess, where there's so many feelings in that
book. So many
book.
Feelings.
But I mean, I did want to reflect on that for a moment because Sophie, traditionally, we find out, has been a big reader of so-called sad girl fiction, right? She said she loved those books when she read them, but now in this particular moment, in this depression, they seem threatening to her. She said, you know,
like a morbid prophecy. If she engages with them too much, she will become Eleanor Oliphant, you know, buying those cappuccinos, which I read that book maybe when it came out. So what's that, 10 years ago or something, maybe even more. I've never forgotten the pathos of those cappuccinos and cheese scones that she would order at work, because what a hideous combination of food and drink. Those things don't match. And I'm like, you don't need to do any more pathos in there. That will see me, right?
Yeah.
So she does love those, but do you know, part of it, because as the author, you get to insert your own opinions and give them to other, you know, to characters. And so Sophie goes off on a little, you know, tangent about sad girl fiction and how she slightly resents the label. And I did that because it means nobody can call this book sad girl fiction and they can't put a sad girl cover on it, because I'm like, I've dismantled sad girl fiction in here. And so we're all safe from that accusation.
A sad girl cover means like a woman's hair,
a woman
no
with
face.
No bones falling against some article of furniture, or, you know, face down on. She's usually prone. Sometimes she's supine. She's often an illustration, but fundamentally she can't support her weight on her own legs. That's how you know that it's a sad girl book.
What was the cover for Sorrow and Bliss?
That was a woman. She was reclining on a sofa, but I would like to say, I would like to cite a Guardian piece that said Sorrow and Bliss, the cover, which obviously I had nothing to do with, you know, it was one of the first. Whether it actually spawned the whole trend, I can't say, but it was before that was sort of a recognizable trend in book covers. But the thing I love about that cover is it actually, when you really look at it, it's more of a mood ring. You know, depending on how you feel, this woman could be in sorrow, in bliss, the way that she's writing. But the cover of Sorrow, of Sophie standing there, I just adore it. And it's not always the way. You don't always love your own cover, as we might assume as readers. But this cover, I feel like just buy it for the cover. You don't have to read it. Just have it on your bedside table. It's so pretty.
I would suggest reading it too. But Sophie, she's done with sad girl fiction. She can't read it. She's too not in a good place. She can't handle all the sad women trapped in her e-reader. So she turns to the work of this other novelist. This is a fictional novelist. Mm-hmm. What happens? She's not even really a big fan of this woman before this.
She's read this author. You know, Sophie's read everybody. So having come to reading much later in life than you would expect, you know, the way book lovers typically describe themselves as, you know, voracious readers as children, which I was then and neither was Sophie. So she's read her, you know, sort of 10 years ago, perhaps. And she says she doesn't quite understand why at the time those books didn't really move her, but she thinks she was probably in the wrong life stage, or maybe she was the wrong demographic, like she says, when she read Sally Rooney, but with an uninvited feeling. But on this particular night when we meet her, which is the last day of the festival, you know, she's about to experience that come down, you know, the end of camp feeling. And they all go out for dinner, she and the other techs. And this author happens to come up. And Sophie's kind of compelled to then Google her on the bus home. And she realizes, she remembers there's one of the books has the words infinite sadness in the title. And something about that just sort of reaches out to her. So she Googles the author's name and best quotes. And she starts scrolling through these quotes. And she has that experience that I hope we all know of something on the page, or indeed phone screen at this point, just comes almost to find her and get her and save her. And she feels this absolute, almost physical pull towards these words. And she says as though, you know, the author knows, she knows what it's like. So if you can't articulate what's happening to her, she wants to kind of screenshot it and show everybody on the bus and say, this is what it's like. This is what it's like. So by the time she gets back to this awful empty flat with no books in it, she, you know, is compelled then to do, again, what we all might recognize as the sort of Google deep dive. And she spends the whole night kind of awake, delving into who this author is. And by the morning, she's sort of fairly attached.
Can you sympathize with this? I mean, have you fallen in love with someone's work or the writer themselves so deeply?
Oh, of course. I think so. And the one that I always think about is when I left New Zealand when I was 18, I was 17, and I wasn't a reader. So I'd never experienced the way that a book can contain your story for you. And then once I got to Australia and I was desperately homesick, desperately lonely, you know, year 12, no chance of making friends in the 9 months that I had, you know, before exams. And somebody gave me Owls Do Cry by the novelist Janet Frame, who's one of the greatest novelists New Zealand has ever produced. And I opened it and I was, how was my life in here? How was all my vernacular and New Zealand birds and the mountains and the rivers and the small towns and, you know, everything about New Zealand that no one in Australia would understand, everything you put away when you move to a new place, it was all in there. I just couldn't believe it. And I think I've always felt this sort of deep gratitude to Janet Frame ever since. And I'm, you know, her biography is inspiring. And there's so many books of hers that I've loved. And I sort of, every stage of my life, when I've gone back to it, there's something else in there, which I think is always a sign of a good book. You know, it's the way you can return to Emma or Pride and Prejudice, and there's something you haven't noticed because it wasn't the moment for you to notice it. And then all of a sudden there it was. And the author's become so alive to you, I think. And in terms of, you know, forming attachments, I think readers are all much more, not necessarily inclined to it, but we're better at it because we're naturally creative. We're trained in imaginary relationships and to believe in relationships that aren't there, because that's why we read novels. And so, you know, maybe we're even just more vulnerable to it and, you know, enjoying it and building out the world of someone else. It's a great pleasure, really.
What about on the other side, Meg? Like, you are a very successful published author.
Am I the object of many strangers' love?
Have you had, you know, that level of admiration from readers?
I certainly experienced things that I would not have experienced. The part that surprised me is that people who come to see you at a festival or in a signing line often tell you in the rush of that moment or the short time that you're going to have together that they love you, and they don't always say "I love the book." They often say "I love you," and it's funny to hear those words from a stranger. And then they will maybe quote you from the book, or they'll show you their copy of the book that's all underlined, and it's amazing and it's incredible. But it's strange to be treated as though you are known by someone who you don't know. You know, and if they've listened to your podcast, and it's always lovely, and I've never felt concerned of like, oh, is this person really attached? It's just that that person wants to tell you something of themselves, which I've also felt like that when I've met an author, because they've given you such an experience and you want to say, this is what it meant to me. And if the book made you feel known, then naturally you feel like the author must know you, you know? And so, and you do get sort of 2 minutes of that wonderful exchange, and then it's over and there might be someone else to have the same exchange with. So it's quite peculiar, but I didn't mind it. I never minded it.
And I'm obviously aware that what you and I are doing right now is part of this, right? Like, we are recording a radio show, a podcast, where
we are.
I am, you know, I'm asking you to reveal more of yourself to listeners. I'm giving listeners more access to you. I mean, is that a strange thing to be the person who is asked to reveal to an audience that you don't see?
I mean, it's slightly, it's almost too much to comprehend it. You know, if I sit here and think someone is presently chopping onions and listening to this, or someone is driving somewhere and, you know, like, that's extraordinary to me. But it can be hard to believe that you're that interesting. Like, I could talk about books all day because they're interesting, but am I really that interesting? But I think what I've learned is, because after Sorrow and Bliss happened, I was really concerned never to believe anything about myself that other people told me, particularly the positive things, because I didn't want to turn into a monster. And what that tends to make you do is to press into humility, which is a good thing. But you can also go too far, and readers don't actually want to necessarily know. They don't necessarily want to see that. So if someone, you know, comes up to you and says, "I love you," they don't want you to say, "Don't be ridiculous. That's stupid. I'm a normal person. You know, that's so embarrassing," because they've put themselves out there to say it. You know, they've made themselves vulnerable. And so you do almost have to find this persona that, you know, isn't monstrous, but you just accept that without thinking, "Oh, and so you should, you know, you should love me." But you have to be the person that they sort of want you to be in that time, because you don't want to send them away disappointed. If I bumped into them in Woolworths, on the other hand, I'm not going to pull out the persona, what my children call Author Meg Mason, as though it's all one word.
Author Meg Mason.
Author Meg Mason. They'll be like, "Author Meg Mason, can you drive me into town?"
Well, Author Meg Mason, it's been so great to spend this time with you today. Your new book is Sophie Standing There. It's published by Fourth Estate. Great to chat again.
Thank you so much. I'll meet you back here in a couple of years.
It's a date.
Thank you.
And you can find my first interview with Meg Mason about her breakout novel Sorrow and Bliss on the Bookshow website. I have put a link to it in the show notes for this episode. And as you've heard, Meg Mason is so funny. It's really worth listening to. Now, before I bring you my next interview with the Australian writer Babak Saeed, you probably know by now that Omar Musa has won this year's Miles Franklin Literary Award for his wonderful novel Fierce Land, this great book about Borneo, complicity, siblings, tree ghosts, hauntings, beads. It's all there. I have spoken to Omar since his win, and there is a bonus episode of The Book Show in our podcast feed. Here's a taste.
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time in Borneo. I only went a few times as a kid, and then, you know, I was born and raised in Australia. But then probably when I was about 19, I went back, really reconnected with my family. And from my early 20s on, I would go at least once a year. And then a couple of years ago, I moved back to Kota Kinabalu in the state of Sabah, which is the easternmost state of Malaysian Borneo, where my dad comes from. And that was a whole other experience. You know, I've described it as being a very enriching, confronting, confusing, soul-stirring experience, but one that was necessary for me as a human, but also for this book, I'd say.
That's Omar Musa speaking to me about his Miles Franklin winning novel, Fierce Land. You can hear that whole conversation in a bonus episode of The Book Show. Just check your podcast feed. You're listening to The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Claire Nichols. So good to be with you. And I'm very pleased to say that Babak Saeed is here now. Babak grew up in Australia. They now call the US home. And Babak has just published their first novel. It's called No God But Us. It's about two queer Afghan men, one from America, one who's been living in Iran. And both of these men are going to find themselves living in Istanbul in 2015. And the timing here is really important because you might remember that this moment, 2015, was this huge turning point in migration and the refugee crisis in Europe. There were all these refugees coming from Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan, and a lot of them were finding themselves kind of stuck and waiting in Istanbul while they were hoping to get to Europe. So, Babak Saeed, welcome to The Book Show.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start with this line in the book that really jumped out to me. The line is, "For all their wonders, it was the privacy of books that made them safe, a cozy haven no one else could touch. Wasn't that why so many troubled children ended up inside their pages?" That's something I've never really thought about, Babak, the privacy of reading.
Yeah, I mean, as with so many of the lines in the book, they are, you know, they can be drawn directly back to my own, like, upbringing and my own childhood. And that line echoes, like, yeah, so much solace that I found in literature and so many of, like, YA books or so many of the sort of adult books I was reading as well were, yeah, about people driven to the margins, about rage, about survival, about people insisting on life.
And you were reading these books, I think, in Perth in Western Australia, right?
Yeah, I was.
How did your family end up in Perth?
It was sort of like a chain migration situation, but we were one of the first Afghan families in Perth because of my uncle who met a Red Cross worker in Afghanistan, whose family was from Perth. So that's our connection to Perth, and I still think very fondly back on my life there, even though it's been a very long time since I've been back.
When you were growing up, did you tell people, yeah, we're from Afghanistan?
You know, it was a very complicated, like, my road to disclosure and cultural pride was challenging. I didn't initially feel very comfortable and confident disclosing that, especially because, you know, I was in, like, elementary school, right, after 9/11, and a lot of the backlash towards Muslims and sort of just, like, growing, just, like, ignorance and hostility from news and from society. So, yeah, it took a while for me to fully, you know, full-chested with who I was and where I came from.
What do you think helped you make that change to that full-chested pride?
You know, I think in a way it was probably leaving. I moved around a lot. My family won the green card lottery, and so I was able to move to America. I lived in Melbourne for a time as a child as well with my sister. And that moving around actually enabled me to reinvent myself, and it was actually such a freedom. So eventually when I moved to America, it was like, you know, I was able to actually just not lie about who I was anymore.
That must feel so freeing.
Yeah, exactly.
The book is about two gay Afghan men. One is American, the other lives in Iran, but they both find themselves in Istanbul around 2015. One man's trying to escape from his family. The other man has kind of been torn away from his family. Can we start with the character of Delbar? Who is he?
Yeah, Delbar is, as you really aptly noted, the story is like, you know, follows these two characters. But what's really important about the difference between them is, like, one is sort of is an American citizen, a sort of child of Afghan refugees. And the other is sort of undergoing the border crisis and the migrant experience. So it's like a lot of the tensions and connections between them are what distinguishes them and what, you know, unites them. And Delbar, yeah, Delbar is coming from a context where he's benefits from native fluency with English. He benefits from, you know, like acculturation in the United States and having all of the, you know, attendant privileges of access to universities and also discourse and language that like Mansoor, a character from, you know, the Afghan diaspora in Iran, is not benefiting from, you know, and the class elements there about like about labor and, you know, just like the different possibilities that are available to people based on what is ultimately a lottery, right? Where we ended up, what our paperwork is, our documentation status. These are major vectors of privilege that we actually had no control in, that none of us earned.
Delbar, we see a scene of him in America before he goes to Istanbul. He's working in this Muslim drag club, and this scene, it really made me hoot with laughter. you've got to tell us first what his drag name is, because it's so good.
Yeah, Sharia Raw. is his drag name.
Sharia Raw. That is so good.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's like it's trying to mess around with and subvert a lot of the stereotypes around, like, you know, how shame is meant to govern our lives and our disclosure and our visibility. And this is like a very immigrant concentrated part of the country, and it's a very different kind of like collective of people who are like not governed by those same sort of, you know, regressive forces.
The scene in that drag bar was so joyful. It was such an amazing way to start the book. But how much of a shock would it be for Delbar's family to find out that he's not only gay, but he's dressing in drag and he's doing that in public?
Yeah, I mean, so much of that existence is predicated on an ability to live a double life and to, you know, engineer this like separation between them. So that's what the big disclosure and sort of the incidents in the first couple of chapters of the book revolve around, is a sort of like dissolution of this barrier between separate lives.
And the family is going to find out, and he is going to flee to family in Istanbul. Meanwhile, Mansoor is an Afghan man in Iran when the book opens. Can you explain, Babak, what it means to be an Afghan man in Iran?
Every community has like a sort of stratification and of like of communities and people who are privileged and who, the sort of underclass and the migrant workers who sort of power the economy and do all the jobs that no one else wants to do, right? So in Iran, Afghans are overwhelmingly the highest sort of like migrant worker population, but they also undergo a lot of discrimination because they're seen as stealing jobs from Iranians. It's a very common narrative all across the world. Like, you know, sort of during times of economic duress, the sort of people who undergo the discrimination and sort of the blame for that economic duress are actually the people powering the economy. They're the migrant underclass. They're the people who are most visibly outsiders. And so, yeah, this like experience of Mansoor and his family in 2015, where, you know, there's like slow incremental reforms allowing undocumented Afghans to enter Iranian schools, but also like the Iranian economy is still suffering a lot under sanctions, and there's like nuclear talks at the time that have obviously since then been fully shredded up. So I think there'll be a lot to resonate for a contemporary reader, and sort of like seeing this moment during Obama's term with Rouhani, like a more progressive former Iranian prime minister, sort of undergoing reforms that we now know like have been totally undermined.
So for various reasons, both men find themselves in Istanbul. I talked in the introduction about the timing here. This is really important. Why did you want to set the majority of this story in Istanbul in this moment in time?
2015 was this real turning point in sort of both global attitudes towards the figure of the asylum seeker and towards like border policy of the European Union around, you know, just like sympathy and receptivity to taking on Afghans, Syrians, Iraqis, etc. Until this moment in 2015, the sort of like gospel that was chronicled in the United Nations Charter after World War II was that like every human being fleeing atrocity and persecution has the right to seek asylum. And in 2015, we really see this sort of like historical pivot the European Union takes towards actually preventing that charter from being exercised, right? So you can still say technically people are allowed to seek asylum, but if you prevent them from doing so, then actually you've nullified the charter in its entirety, right?
And Istanbul, right, became something of like a holding bay for people who were coming from the Middle East and waiting to get to Europe. Is that the case?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like a bottleneck, right, where the borders up until Istanbul across Western Europe and North Africa permit a sort of more, just a easier access into and across Turkey and into Istanbul, which is right on the border of Europe, right? And so what you saw, especially in 2015, was this huge surge of refugee communities into and around an already gigantic city like Istanbul, with people launching their applications for humanitarian asylum into Europe, yes, also into Canada, also into Australia. You know, like people were really just throwing their fate to any government in any direction that would take them. But also in the interim, living in this sort of purgatory, right? Like waiting sometimes years to try to get a chance and opportunity at a different life. And so the book is sort of concerned with like this interim moment, right? Where people are like looking for a different future, dreaming of a new home, but also reckoning with what it means to live in the here and now, right? Like what kind of life is made for them? What are the opportunities at their disposal now? And what is their responsibility to each other and to the city?
And part of living a life, of course, is falling in love. An interesting part of this novel, No God But Us, is that we see both men experience that rush of first love, you know, the kind of beautiful wonder of it and the kind of pain of first love. What did you want to explore about first love in this novel?
Yeah, I think that there's a little bit of pessimism there too, I think, in what I wanted to explore, because there is a sense of like, especially with Mansoor, Mansoor has this experience in Iran where he sort of like throws himself into an experience quite recklessly with a man he falls in love with, you know, and suffers quite profound consequences for that love. And I think for someone like Mansoor in particular, it really teaches him a kind of ugly lesson. And it's an ugly lesson that like, in fact, being reckless for love and like throwing yourself out there when you're living in the sort of lowest rungs of society has grave consequences. And it means that he has to close up his heart. And, you know, that first love then becomes a sort of like warning about having lost everything once. And it leads him to sort of like second guess whether he can, you know, make such sacrifices again.
And then we see Delbar become instantly obsessed with Mansoor when he meets him. You know, Delbar's 6 years younger. He's looking at this beautiful man. And he is just as besotted as we once saw Mansoor being. And there's a pain there in, I think, us watching Delbar throw himself into this, having just seen Mansoor's experience of first love in previous chapters.
That's it. Yeah. And it's heartbreaking, because I think that's the beauty when you're writing a novel is you want to construct something that isn't simply a screenplay or that can't simply be accomplished via a screen, right? Like as novelists and as writers, we need to insist not simply on the form for the sake of like the history of the novel and the history of this art form, but in fact like invent and engineer like ways that the book and the novel can actually do things that film and TV cannot. And one of the ways that a novel can do that is like with this sort of the things that the reader knows, you're sort of navigating all of these characters with their different levels of, you know, their limited access to one another.
I mentioned that this is your first novel. What was the moment like, Babak, when you got to hold No God But Us in your hands for the first time?
So it was such a gorgeous moment, like really unfathomable. It's, you know, a book is such a dream that so many years of labor and patience go into, and so getting to hold it and also share it with so many people, yeah, it was absolutely a dream come true.
Well, it's been such a pleasure to meet you today. Your novel is No God But Us. It's published by Ultimo Press. But Buck Saeed, great to meet you today.
Thank you so much for having me, Clara. Take care.
And that's the book show for now. Today you heard from Buck Saeed, whose novel is No God But Us, and from Meg Mason, whose book is Sophie Standing There. And make sure you're following The Book Show on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts, because next time I am going to be talking to Vikas Swaroop. He is a former Indian diplomat, but most importantly, he is the guy who wrote the novel Q&A, which became the film Slumdog Millionaire. He has a new book. It's called The Girl with Seven Lives, and it does introduce us to another slumdog. But this girl, she's not going to be a millionaire. In fact, she might get murdered. Make sure you come back next time for that one. Big thank you to Sarah Lestrange, the producer of The Book Show. We make this show on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.